Are you an artist, band, or record label? We want you to send us your music so we can put it on the radio. Not only this station, but stations across Canada. Check out earshot-distro.ca and share your music with more than 100 radio stations and programmers across the country. Earshot Distro is made by and for the campus community radio sector to help emerging musicians. Uploads cost $7 per song or $50 per album. Learn more at earshot-distro.ca.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby, where you can engage with us via our website at cjsf.ca or on our social media, which is CJSF Radio on TikTok and Blue Sky, or CJSF Music and CJSF Talk on Instagram.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, we speak with Ramzi Baroud, Palestinian-American writer, editor, and commentator. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Genocidal war on Gaza drags on with no end in sight. 61,000 have been killed by U.S. bombs and missiles. There have been a few German and British missiles and bombs there. Indirect deaths from infectious disease, chronic ailments that can no longer be treated, and malnutrition may bring that number to 200,000. Last week, Israel launched a full-scale assault on northern Gaza, home to an estimated million Palestinians. Benjamin Netanyahu's aim? To drive them and the remainder of the estimated 2.1 million Gazans who've managed to survive Israel's biblical onslaught into a vast concentration camp on the southern end of the enclave, there to be perfidiously bombed, to perish from starvation and disease, or to pack up and get out. Israel is reportedly in negotiations with Libyan and Sudanese authorities to accept Palestinian deportees. Meanwhile, a slew of Western leaders have vowed to recognize Palestinian statehood at the 80th session of the UN General Assembly scheduled to convene in New York City on September 8th. That, they say, is the best way to secure what they call peace. Palestinian statehood with conditions. Only Western-approved Palestinian parties and candidates will be allowed to run. Hamas will be excluded, of course. Palestine will have to be demilitarized, therefore defenseless in the face of certain Israeli assault, and Palestine will be obliged to guarantee Israeli security. With me to talk about all this is a gentleman named Ramzi Baroud. Ramzi Baroud is a U.S.-Palestinian journalist and author. He's the editor of the Palestine Chronicle, former managing editor of London-based Middle East Eye, and former deputy managing editor of Al Jazeera Online. Ramzi Baroud is the author of 6 books and a contributor to many others. His latest volume, co-edited with British-Israeli author Ilan Pappé, entitled Our Vision for Liberation, Engaged Palestinian Leaders and Intellectuals Speak Out. Ramzi Baroud, welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you for having me, David. Pleasure.
Ramzi, what is your vision for liberation?
Well, my vision for liberation is the vision of the Palestinian people. And it's the vision that Palestine cannot be liberated without agency, without the Palestinian people being at the core of any just solution to their own plight, to their own struggle. And this is what we are driving for. As intellectuals, as Palestinian intellectuals, we are constantly trying to center the Palestinian narrative, to center Palestinian history. And to do so is to acknowledge the significance and importance of Palestinian resistance, and resistance means agency. So once we have all of these components in order, and I do believe that what is happening in Gaza right now, what's been going on in the last couple of years, has really indicated that the world is ready now for Palestinian agency and for Palestinians to be the center and the core of their own struggle for freedom and liberation.
Now, when you say the world is ready for that, you're talking about global civil society.
That's right, of course.
Western leaders are another matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, what you mentioned earlier about what's going to happen supposedly on September 8th about the conditional recognition of Palestine, I think it's really indicative of the struggle globally right now, where you have civil society that is openly talking about Palestinians' right to defend themselves and about accountability from Israel and all the sensitivities of, you know, kind of the dilly-dallying, if you will, of how do we criticize Israel and what is the politest way of doing it without appearing to be, you know, racist or anti. We're moving past all of this now, and the world as civil society, as ordinary people, are ready to move on to a different kind of discourse. And as a result, these governments in Europe, which have been feeding the Israeli genocide, I mean, the Israeli genocide would have not happened in the first place if it was not for the blank check, the wholesale support coming from the West to Israel to do whatever it wants to do to the Palestinians. We have been talking about genocide or incremental genocide in Palestine for many years. And they didn't do anything. They continued to feed the Israeli military machine, the Israeli death machine. Suddenly, they are now becoming aware of the fact that the world is changing in a direction that does not please them. And this is why they are trying to regain the initiative. I think all of these ideas about recognizing Palestine, but on the condition that the resistance has to be marginalized, Hamas has to be out of the picture, only the Western sanctioned Palestinian Authority has to be accepted as the representative of the Palestinian people, even though they are extremely unpopular among Palestinians and have no democratic credentials whatsoever. It doesn't matter. So this is, in my mind, it's the West trying to regain initiative, and still everything they are doing largely still goes in the direction of Israel, still done on behalf of Israel to protect Zionism from the folly of Netanyahu, to protect Israel from the implosion that is happening within the Zionist movement. This is about Israel, has nothing to do with the Palestinians and their quest for justice, freedom, and liberation.
We've touched on a number of key points here, and I want to get back to some of them. But just to put a fine point on this, the future of liberation, your vision of liberation, right? I mean, liberation, that's the light at the end of the tunnel. It's the holy grail far off in the distance. My question is, the nightmare, the cataclysm in Gaza today, it blows my mind what Israel is completely free to do, and it's committing genocide, and it is launched into ethnic cleansing, and the enormity of it kind of boggles my mind. So my question is, setting aside liberation, what's your vision of how this is going to end? Will there be a million dead and successful ethnic cleansing? And we can, you know, how awful could that look? Or will the international community, quote unquote, actually intervene? I mean, not make statements at the UN, but actually intervene to stop it What's going to happen? And this is the big question. Is Israel going to succeed in annihilating the people of Gaza and the West Bank, because it's going on in the West Bank right now? Will they succeed, or will the international community suddenly, finally step in an organized fashion and stop it?
Right. So in order for us to answer this question, because this is the million-dollar question, and everybody is trying to push or impose an answer that is consistent with their own political vision and strategy. Israel wants to finish off the Palestinian people, literally. And they are working very, very hard to do so. In conversations with various Gaza doctors, they explained to me, I mean, at one point, you know, myself and many others think that starvation is the result of just people not eating over a long period of time, and then they just die from hunger. But even if food is suddenly available, a lot of them will continue to die anyway, because the, you know, that what malnutrition does to the human body is something that cannot be reactivated suddenly just with a loaf of bread and some milk. So we are talking here about a society that, even if we are to argue that the war stops right now, are going to continue to die from consequences related to the war. And the Lancet medical journal spoke about it extensively. Of if the war is to stop right now, this is still going to continue to happen. Israel is indeed in a quest of matching its genocidal discourse with actual genocide. When they talk about finishing off Palestinians, killing Palestinians, dropping a nuclear bomb on Palestinians, as Eliyahu, the Israeli Minister of Heritage, spoke repeatedly, and every Palestinian child is the enemy, in the words of Moshe Figlin, or there are no innocent people in Gaza, in the words of the Israeli President Herzog. I mean, all of this really does indicate, and of course, kind of applying that to what's happening on the ground, all of this indicates that Israel is trying to finish off the Palestinian people. And whomever remain and they want to get out through Rafah or through other means to Sudan or Libya, as you mentioned, they are more than welcome to do so. But the idea is indeed eradication, extermination. The Palestinian people are fully aware of this. We know exactly what Israel wants to do. We've been warning against it for such a long time. Nobody was listening to us because we were removed from our own narrative. And this is something that I've been talking about for a long time. When we say centering Palestinians, we are not talking sentimental poetry here. We are saying that if you listen to us in the first place, you would have predicted that this was going to happen. And if you look at my own writing saying that this is Israel's intention, and it's happening now, and still mainstream media doesn't even talk to us. You know, we are, you know, for whatever reason, we don't even belong to the mainstream conversation on our own genocide, which we have predicted for decades. What the international community, and this is coming back to your question, sorry for the long loop, the international community is, you know, if we are look at the U.S.-led international community, and unfortunately, our international community is still beholden to American Western powers, they are trying to find a middle ground. They want to achieve part of Israel's intentions or part of Israel's objectives, eliminating the Palestinian resistance, kind of dictating the political terms on the Palestinians, envisaging a Palestinian state, at least in theory, that will have no arms and no defined boundaries and so forth and so on. But at the same time, kind of try to save face here by keeping some Palestinians, by not allowing Israel to carry out the full unhindered genocide and extermination of the Palestinian people. Will the international community understand that this position basically is kind of a nod of approval for Netanyahu to carry on doing what he's doing? Because the international community's position has no accountability, no enforcement, no action of any kind. It's just moral positions, political positions, a strategic interpretation of events. Comes September, if, you know, the British are saying, comes September, if Israel does not relent and stop the war, then we shall, recognize a Palestinian state Well, maybe half of the people of that state will be either dead, wounded, mutilated, pushed out. It doesn't matter, but that's just a political position. For us Palestinians, maybe that position would have meant something on October 6, 2023. It means absolutely nothing now, because we are talking about our entire families, clans, tribes, villages, towns, people being completely finished off. So a symbolic gesture towards some recognition that is conditional for some kind of a Palestine that is going to be created, if it ever happens, by a group of people who see themselves as kind of floating within the Western political sphere, like the likes of Mahmoud Abbas and others, that doesn't mean anything to us whatsoever.
Last week in the emergency UN Security Council session, several countries articulated the idea of a Chapter 7 resolution. There were two or three of them who said, we need to come up with a Chapter 7 resolution under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which would be a binding resolution that it would engage actual intervention. And it would be so simple. Of course, this would require the United States to be on board, and this may be just total fantasy. But, you know, Trump cannot get Putin to stop the war on Ukraine. I mean, he just can't. He doesn't have the capacity. But Trump could end the war in Gaza just like that, right? With a phone call, several phone calls, and a Chapter 7 resolution, which would bring home the hostages. I mean, Hamas would immediately hand back the hostages, I'm sure, if there were to be an intervention force and they were to tell Israel to get out and actually, you know, force Israel to get out, stage, you know, an amphibious entry into Gaza. It could happen. I mean, it sounds huge. Of course, it's fantasy, but it could be done. It could happen. And so my question is, I mean, is this just fantasy? Or can you imagine, I mean, I was just reading, like, Egypt has got, I didn't know this, Egypt has got the largest navy in the Middle East and the 12th largest navy in the world, Egypt. I mean, Egypt could, you know, having informed the United States and the Europeans about this, send this navy off the coast of Gaza and say, we're intervening.
Is the Egypt okay? This is really,
without getting into the specifics,
I mean,
of
it
Egypt,
is a fantasy in the sense that it doesn't really acknowledge what are the geopolitical balances in the region are. What's happening in Gaza is entirely different than what's happening in the Ukraine, not just because of the nature of the genocide, but also because of the political play. At least Ukraine has solid alliances. I mean, Europeans, I mean, I'm in Europe now and I've been traveling a lot here, and I'm fully aware of the media discourses and the support that is coming from the European countries of Ukraine. The US, despite the occasional reluctance, they continue to support Ukraine. What is the Arab equivalent of this alliance that has been supporting Ukraine over the years? You know, what is what is Egypt's location in this? What is Jordan? To the contrary, when Israel bombed Iran, Jordan was not involved in terms, did not activate its air defenses to block that attack. When the Iranians retaliated, Jordan was there ready to shoot down any Iranian threat to Israel. The Egyptians continue to trade with Israel. In fact, the total trade volume between Egypt and Israel has increased during the genocide.
And Al-Sisi has just said that what Israel is doing is a genocide.
Yeah, he's saying that because of what's happened in Egypt. I mean, Western media is not reporting on what's taking place in Egypt. At one point, there was a siege on numerous Egyptian embassies in Europe of just exiled Egyptians basically taking the initiative of holding Sisi accountable and responsible for the blockade on Gaza as much as Israel. There is a lot of fury coming from Egyptian society. People are speaking out about it. It has not yet translated to the form of mobilization because they don't have the freedom to do so. So there is some fear here. in Egypt. There are two kind of layer type kinds of fear. The first layer is that Egypt is worried that there will be internal implosion within Egyptian society if the Palestinians are being pushed to the Sinai Desert. The second, it seems that the CZ has reached a conclusion, and we know that the CZ and others have been aware of the fact that the Americans have, you know, under Antony Blinken at the time, during the Biden administration, have been pushing for Egypt to accept a certain number of Palestinians who would be pushed to the Sinai temporarily until they are pushed back. We know historically that when Palestinian refugees are pushed out of Palestine, there's no temporary anything. They remain out forever and ever. So this is the real fears of Sisi. He's under a lot of pressure by the Americans and others, but from his own society. So he needed to create some kind of language that may appear to indicate that Sisi is fed up or Sisi is on the side of the Palestinians. There's absolutely no indications of that whatsoever. So back to my point, Ukraine has friends, real friends and supporters, right or wrong, that's a whole different conversation. Palestine doesn't. Our support comes from a civil society worldwide, but it doesn't have the kind of political leverage that is able to translate that support to real pressure. We have seen strong positions from Spain, from Norway, from Ireland, from Slovenia. We have seen very, very strong support coming from South Africa, from Namibia, from Bolivia, from Cuba, from Venezuela, and so forth and so on. But these are not the countries that determine the flow of international politics. So to the very, very original question you ask, what will happen? I think Israel will fail. And I don't think it's going to fail because of the international pressure. I think that's a component of it. I think it will fail because the Palestinian people have made a collective decision that we all die in our land and we're not going to go anywhere. And this is something that we as Palestinians have been discussing, as Palestinian historians have been discussing for many, many years. Why did the Palestinians in 1948, why did they, some of them, yes, a lot of them were pushed out. Yes, massacres were committed. But why did they leave? Why didn't they just stay and fight and die in their own homeland? And the answer to that is that because they really were under the pressure. Like my grandfather was under the impression that the international community is not going to allow us, you know, the world is just not going to allow us just to go and live in refugee camps forever. We left because they were massacring people, so we wanted to achieve a degree of safety for our families, but naturally we had to come back. Well, they were not allowed to come back. And as a result, there is very strong belief among Palestinians that if you are pushed back out, you will never come back, and we are not going to allow Israel to achieve another Nakba. The former chief of the Israeli intelligence made a statement that was leaked to Israeli media a couple of days ago, in which he said, Palestinians need a Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948, need a Nakba once in a while just to be kept in line. So Israel is trying to achieve a Nakba. The Palestinians are pushing back against the Nakba. I think the answer to your question is that whomever is able to get what he wants, a Nakba or no Nakba, is going to end up prevailing at the end. And when I say prevailing from the Palestinian side, I mean, how do you prevail when a genocide has already been committed? Yes, but you prevail at least in the sense that you're still there. You survived. You maintain that element of nationhood, because we Palestinians, when we are scattered, the element of nationhood becomes a lot weaker. Only when you are in your own homeland, nationhood matters. And we want to stay in Gaza. Our people want to stay in Gaza, no matter the pain, the collective pain, and no matter the price.
Let's get back to that in a second, Ramzi. But so we've talked about the Jordanians, we've talked about the Egyptians. How about the Saudis? How about Mohammed bin Salman? Like, my question is, ultimately, if Trump were to end the war, and he could do it immediately, he would do it because he would see it as being in his interest, in his personal interest, that there'd be a deal there, and that his interlocutor is somebody who can make a deal, who can deliver the goods. And I see Mohammed bin Salman and the leaders of, the UAE and Qatar, I mean, as being the ones who could say to Trump, look, if you want, trade and investments with us, then there has to be a Palestinian state, and the occupation, Israel's occupation, has got to end. And in my mind, I'm thinking, if Mohammed bin Salman and these other guys from the UAE and Qatar were to go to the White House and tell Trump this and mean it, that could turn Trump around. So how about MBS?
You would think so, but the Saudis, I mean, they were actually clear in this position even before the genocide. When they were under a lot of pressure to normalize, they did not mind other Arabs normalizing, but they did not feel, because Saudi Arabia, you have to understand that Saudi Arabia has a particular position, a particular role to serve within the greater kind of, political layout of the Middle East. This is the place in which the holy shrines are. They have the spiritual credibility. This is the place in which millions of Muslims go to every year for pilgrimage. It's not United Arab Emirates. United Arab Emirates is the lost cause, and they have been really happily collaborating with Israel. The United Arab Emirates people, it's not like they are being forced to do so. They are under pressure from anybody. They are giddy. They want to be part of whatever Israeli-American camp is, being formed in the region. The Saudis are in a different position. They have, a great deal of historical position to play here, and they have to maintain that. They want to normalize, but Israel is refusing or has been refusing to give them anything of value. Now, from a Saudi point of view, I have all this money, all of this wealth, all of these economic and investment opportunities, and I'm going to give you something. What are you going to give me back? Well, I'm going to protect you against Iran. Well, you can't even protect yourself against Iran. Not just that, the Saudis made that conclusion even before the genocide, and they reached out to the Iranians, I think through Oman, and they sorted out their differences. So the Saudis feel no sense threat from the Iranians whatsoever. So why should the Saudis lose their credibility entirely in the Middle East, normalize with Israel without something that they can sell, kind of market to their people, but also to Arabs and Muslims everywhere, that they have, we have done it for Palestine?
Why wouldn't they tell Trump, look, if you want to do trade and investment with us Saudis, you've got to end the occupation and end Israel's, get Israel out?
You're saying that they need to leverage, and the Arabs haven't leveraged their economic prowess since 1973. And in 1973, when they leveraged their oil exports, I mean, it really created global, I mean, it reverberated globally that the Arabs actually have some kind of power. They never followed through with that. Will the Saudis be able to leverage their power again? I think technically they can. Is there enough political will for them to do so, to clash with the U.S. globally and openly? That's a whole different question. Is Palestine worthy enough for the Saudis to kind of put it all on the line and say an independent Palestinian state or nothing? That is a question that will ultimately go back to the Saudi ruling elites, not to me. But I think, they could. They should have that kind of power. And if they do it now, imagine the kind of credibility that they will have among, within the region and worldwide, not just with Arabs and Muslims, but worldwide, that someone is finally translating words into action. So hopefully they could do something of this nature. The sad thing is that they haven't done it already.
What do those guys think about Mahmoud Abbas and Hamas? I mean, we know the Saudis and the Arabs, the rest of the Arab world, maybe I'm stepping out too far, but they loathe Hamas. They hold Hamas in contempt, and they have no respect for Abbas. Abbas is just some aging guy who doesn't represent his people, and he's got no cred, no power, nothing to say or to do. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong at all. I don't think the Palestinians, not I don't think, I know that the Palestinians themselves have zero respect for Mahmoud Abbas, a money-hungry person who kind of found himself in this position bringing all the most corrupt of our society around him, and they are trying to keep this, you know, this treasure trove open, you know, the international aid and donors' money and so on.